This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, anti-war activists prepare to gather in Baltimore to find ways to halt the spread of U.S. military bases around the world. The job of organizing against corporate power may get a lot more difficult with the end of internet neutrality. And the U.S.-backed regime in the Democratic Republic of Congo opens fire on protesters organized by the Catholic Church.
But first, Omali Yeshetela, chairman of the Blackest-backed coalition, says reverence for the martyrs of Black struggle, those who have given their lives for Black people, needs to be rekindled.
That's absolutely correct. And I think that there's a reason why even issues like martyrdom are so important to Muslims and to other people. The first real demonstration of a recognition and appreciation of martyrdom that I saw personally was when I was in Nicaragua shortly after the revolution there. And there was a deep appreciation for those people who in our communities had died through fighting against the reaction there. And certainly as it was implemented by the Reagan administration that initiated a real bloody assault upon the people of Nicaragua who had simply determined that they wanted to run their own lives. And you saw in Nicaragua communities that have been split, sometimes right down the middle, between those who supported neocolonialism and continuing U.S. domination, those who wanted to be free. And there was a high appreciation for those people who had struggled and died for the sake of their freedom. And in this country, as you know, there have been so many Africans who have been murdered, and it's a constant, a perennial assault on the community, deaths around every corner. Every day we look up, the cops have shot somebody else that we know about, that we read about in the newspaper, or a court has relieved a cop for any responsibility, or an ordinary white person of any responsibility for killing us. And it happens every place. And the thing is that this ability of the United States government to kill us, and most often with impunity, is something that is designed not only to kill an individual, but to crush the will of an oppressed people to struggle. And that's one of the reasons you will see, even like with the assassinations of people like King and Malcolm X, that they didn't have to kill King the way they did or Malcolm the way they did. They could have made it appear that they slipped in the bathtub or had an automobile accident or something to that effect. But they wanted it to be exemplary. They wanted these deaths to be examples to the entire colonized, oppressed African community that this is what would happen to you if you would stand up for self-determination. And I remember a quote from J. Edgar Hoover, longtime architect of much of the oppression that was coming from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the U.S. domestic political police, who had declared that part of what the task of the FBI was to make every young Black person understand that to become a Black revolutionary is to become a dead revolutionary. And so this was something that was done, again, to crush the will of the people to resist. This is why the murder of Mike Brown in August of 2014 resulted in the police leaving his body on the 100-degree-plus asphalt for 4.5 hours. It wasn't because they didn't have ambulances or didn't know their address or couldn't get there, but it was to be an example for African people that resistance standing up to the state, standing up to police will result in this kind of death. So the fact is that they kill us, they jail us, they kill us to crush our will to struggle. And we have to take that away from them. The ability for them to use death, the murder of our leaders, the murder of Black people as a reason to stop the fight. We have to take that from them. And the question of martyrdom arms us. And in fact, it says this is exactly why you have to fight. And to fight and resist oppression is glorious and wonderful. It's a good thing, not a bad thing. And that every African, every oppressed Black person in this country and in the world should be willing to stand up even at the risk of life, because there's something more important than life itself, and that is life as a free people. So in 1981, at the first Congress of the African People's Socialist Party, we passed a resolution calling for February 21st, which is actually the day that Malcolm X was assassinated, February 21st, to recognize that day as the day of the African martyr, and that black people everywhere should look not only at Malcolm and Lumumba and King and Bobby Hutton, but even in our own communities, black people who have been killed, sometimes like Mike Brown or others, and hold them up as martyrs so that they do not become just some dead people, dead black people that demoralize us, but rather they should become symbols of why we have to resist, why we have to fight.
But you also say, in a broader sense, we should examine and put in context the deaths of folks who are not killed directly by the coercive forces of the state, but by other black folks, that these horizontal casualties, as they're sometimes called, are also victims of oppression.
I think that's extremely important, because that's part of what the government does and all of the media, the colonial bourgeois media, use to gloat about the ineptitude of our community, to show how without more cops and more intervention by the state, the colonial state, that black people would just kill ourselves. And it's a narrative that also you hear coming from our own communities, from pulpits, from classrooms, and from neighborhoods, that look at what we do to ourselves. And I think that we have a responsibility to contextualize that, to say that this is something that happens to a people that lives under total domination, that people control food, clothing, housing, how are we going to eat, what are we going to eat, where are we going to school, if we're going to go to school. Everything about our lives as a people is under colonial domination. And so when you see the kinds of violence, horizontal violence that happens between us, it is a response to this relationship that we have to an oppressive colonial state, and that we have to include this as part of the whole system and a brutality and violence that's imposed on us. And I think that this also can struggle against the kind of demoralization that happens in our community. And I think it also arms us in this contest, how the government works to split our community by saying stuff like, instead of fighting against police killing black people, you're never fighting against black on black violence, as they characterize it. And what we want to say, even black on black violence is white on black violence. And that we see all of this as the police murder, the murder of Junebug by somebody else in the community, having a relationship to the same conditions that we suffer as a whole people. And we want to attack this split so that we can see marches and mobilizations in our communities where people who are involved in horizontal violence, the families of these victims, the families of the victims of people who were killed by the police, can march arm in arm, recognizing that we are being victimized by the same social system and the same set of circumstances that has been imposed on us by gunpoint.
And now it appears that the government is preparing a whole new crop of martyrs under the heading of black identity extremists to be hunted down and corralled and dealt with.
And I think that's extremely important. And I think that also this is a characterization, this black identity extremist, that is designed to split the community too, between the non-extremists and the extremists. The good people who never thought about doing anything bad, separating from the government, or who never thought about self-defense or anything like that, against those people who have adopted the position by any means necessary, we have to be free. And I would remind people that this is not the first time we've seen such an organized kind of program and campaign implemented in our community, that we saw it in the 1960s with the counterintelligence program that was adopted by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, and that this was a campaign that had a net that included not only the Black Panther Party and Malcolm X, who they had killed previously, but also Martin Luther King. They named Martin Luther King by name, as a person who, depending on how he acted in the future, could be someone who would be targeted. They identified Malcolm X as already somebody who was a martyr from before they created this particular program. And so The point is that if they can get one sector of the community to stand aside while they attack another sector of the community that they've branded in a certain fashion, then what they have effectively done is been able to organize and unite a lot of people to watch the most effective, the most dynamic, the most activist sector of the community fighting for the interests of the community, wipe them out, and that leaves the rest of the community open to be preyed upon by the system. So if they can split the community by characterizing some part of the community as Black identity extremists, and they do that because these are the communities who are outstanding, who vanguard for the whole community, then it makes it easier for them to enhance the colonial domination of the entire population. Self-determination is the thing that frightens them, and that's why they would characterize Black nationalist hate groups, and that's why they would characterize Black identity extremists, because these are people who recognize that we are being attacked precisely because we are Black, and they don't want us to have that consciousness.
And how are you proposing that we institutionalize within the movement honoring of these martyrs?
I think that it would be really ideal if on February 21st, which is the anniversary again of the assassination of Malcolm X, it would be ideal if we were able, wherever we're located, to have open events to honor not only people like Malcolm and Martin, but people in our own communities, to see if we can organize the communities to come together and deal with the whole question of violence that's impacting on our community, highlighting, of course, the well-known martyrs, but also people who suffer from horizontal violence, to institute forums and discussions and marches against the violence, again, contextualizing it as a consequence of the colonial domination. And that between now and the 21st, that we begin to do actions, we begin to promote the idea of Martyrs' Day, of a Martyrs' Day, Black Martyrs' Day, African People's Martyrs' Day, as victims of this relationship that we have to colonial white power. So that's what we are suggesting, that from now until the 21st, that we initiate activities, that we promote the idea of the African martyr, the Black martyr, and include the well-known people like Malcolm and others like that, but also include Sandra Bland and include Mike Brown and include Eric Garner and those folks, but also the people in our community who are well-known. Because we've got to open the door for that sector. Because if we don't, what happens is the government takes these victims of horizontal violence, their families, and then they use them against the rest of us, and they use them to be able to call the police as the force that should control our communities. So these people are hurt. So you have families who've lost their loved ones, and it's happened through horizontal violence. They're dead. That's what they know. And the police didn't kill them, but the community doesn't respond to them the same way we respond to someone if the police did kill them. We got to respond to them all and place the onus of responsibility of the ones of killed Mike Brown as the same as the one who responsible for the horizontal violence in our community. Unite the entire community against
them. That was Somali Yeshetela, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition, speaking from St. Petersburg, Florida.
The United States has as many as 1,000 military bases around the world, a far bigger military presence on the planet than any other nation or empire in history. Anti-war activists from around the country will gather at the University of Baltimore January 12th through 14th to discuss ways to scale back or eliminate the U.S. military grip on the planet. We spoke with anti-war activist and author David Swanson, publisher of the influential website War is a Crime.
The thinking that a whole bunch of different peace organizations had was probably right, that you can get a pretty big crowd and a pretty big coalition organized and in agreement on closing U.S. military bases in other people's countries. It's not exactly the same thing as opposing a particular politician or party or a particular war or a particular escalation of a particular war. It's part of the infrastructure, and it's, you know, not the most expensive part, not the most destructive part possibly, but it's a part that's very obviously not defensive. people imagine the Defense Department as defensive because it's called the Defense Department. And you could go through 80-90% of it and show that there's no defensive purpose to this, that, or the other. But bases in other people's countries, in many cases, deeply resented and protested bases that get the United States into wars rather than keeping it out of wars. It's an obvious one. It's low-hanging fruit. If we're going to have an anti-war movement, a demilitarization movement, this is a place to start. And so the conference is sold out. You know, sometimes some people don't show up and some other people might be able to get in, but it seems to be a popular idea.
The scale of U.S. bases overseas is so vast, it sometimes seems that the U.S. is occupying the world.
You know, I watch a lot of basketball games because the University of Virginia is so darn good, and I'm just disgusted because every single game they thank the troops for watching from 175, sometimes they say more than 175 or 177 countries. They thank the almost a million, you know, men and women serving our country. What the service is, they don't explain why they have to be in 177 countries. The fact that there are only about 200 countries on Earth, that there's at least a dozen more countries they're not telling us, you know, these are the ones they admit to. What are they doing there? What are they needed for? And in some cases, it's thousands. In some cases, it's tens of thousands, 50,000 troops still in Germany, still winning World War II, you know, three quarters of a century later. It's insanity. And of course, it costs hundreds of billions of dollars for people who think that we're running low on money and we can't afford things. We could afford anything we wanted if we didn't do things this stupid.
Yes, of course, the bases are very expensive, and it becomes almost impossible to talk about reducing the military budget if you don't get rid of a large portion of these bases.
Well, it's a big chunk, you know. I mean, across numerous departments, you've got over $1 trillion just from the U.S. government alone each and every year for nothing other than war and preparations for war, you know. And people do these calculations and express their outrage that this war or that war, that Iraq and Afghanistan have cost a total of $4 trillion over a certain number of years or something. You know, this is just scratching the surface. It's $1 trillion every year. Over 15 years, it's $15 trillion. And a big chunk of that is for these bases. It's at least $150, $200 billion every year. And then you've got the ships in the oceans and the transport to and from the various bases, the weapons that are installed at these bases. A lot of times, the whole point of having the base is to install missiles along the border of Russia to protect the United States from Iran or whatever the excuse is. If you're going to shut down this incredible military machine, you can start with the nuclear weapons, you can start with the submarines, you could start anywhere, but this is such an obvious place because people understand it and because it is such a big expense and because it's so harmful to relations with the rest of the world. A lot of Americans don't realize that this is the face that their country presents to much of the world's public. This is how people come into contact with the United States, with the U.S. military, the U.S. troops, the U.S. troops in Honduras supporting an unelected coup government, the U.S. troops in Okinawa and in Japan and in South Korea and in Italy and in Germany being protested and resented day after day.
Well, sometimes that U.S. face is covered during the investigation into the death of U.S. Special Forces personnel in Niger. It was revealed that, well, much of the Congress didn't even know there were U.S. personnel in Niger and the bases that are necessary to service them.
I don't know how they could expect to keep up, but they also aren't told. A lot of this is secret. It's kept from the Congress, and of course it's kept from the public. I mean, we've learned of numerous bases over the years because there was blowback. You know, we found out where there was a drone operating base in Afghanistan because somebody went and attacked it. Other people find out before we find out. But no, we're not told, we're not consulted, we're not asked, and for the most part, neither is Congress. in some cases, certain committee members are informed. You know, but I used to live many years ago in Italy, and then some years later, I found out the U.S. wanted to build this enormous new military base in the town where I had lived in Italy, and I brought Italian friends to Congress to talk with key staff people and committee members, and they had known about it for years before a single person in Italy had heard about it. The people in the countries where the bases are imposed are not asked, and in most cases don't want them, and in most cases don't have governments willing to stand up to the United States in the way, say, the president of Ecuador did when he said, you can keep your troops here if we can have a base in Miami. The people of South Korea overthrew their government last year and put in place a government that was supposed to stand up to the United States. And that lasted about 15 minutes.
Who is the constituency in the United States for these overseas U.S. bases? We know that lots of folks will fight to keep domestic military facilities in their neighborhoods, in their states, in their counties, because they provide jobs. But for this vast overseas empire of bases, who's the constituency?
It's hard to say. I think arguably there isn't one. There's no big popular movement to support them, to maintain them, or to expand them, not in the United States and not abroad. There are, of course, profits to be made. There are jobs for the troops and support personnel, although many of them are not American, at the bases. And there are jobs for the weapons dealers. But as economists will tell you, you could have more jobs, better paying jobs, and of course, environmentally superior, politically superior, morally superior jobs by spending the money otherwise. So there's not an economic argument, and there's not a selfish backyard argument, because these are not particular real jobs in somebody's district or state, unless you're counting these territories as states and possessions of the United States. But there's not that kind of representation in Washington. These are bases being imposed on people who don't want them by a government that's failing to represent its people that also doesn't want them.
Yes, that is the point. The United States pretends that it has this vast network of bases because all these countries want the United States military presence in their countries. But it's much more like a case of coercion. You take our bases or we'll make trouble for you.
Yeah, to the extent that it's in the name of democracy, it is an out-and-out lie. If bases in countries could be put to a public vote, whether a U.S. public vote or a public vote in the countries where the bases are, many, if not most, of these bases would be closed immediately. And if we could put together a program of actual aid, not so-called military aid, I was speaking with a guy from California whose aunt, Berta Cáceres, was assassinated in Honduras. And he was telling me that he wasn't sure the U.S. shouldn't have a base in Honduras, that it was sort of a fact of life. Everybody accepts it. It's okay. And I said, why? What good does it do? He said, well, they helped when there was a hurricane. And I said, but yeah, but what if we trained people in hurricane assistance rather than training people and arming people to kill and then using the excuse of the hurricane to send them in and having them do a little bit of hurricane assistance? And he said, oh, well, yeah, of course, that would be better. So if we could transform these bases into something useful, if the United States could provide actual aid, which of course financially would cost much less than maintaining these bases, the support abroad for bases, to the extent that there is any, would evaporate. And you can go across the political spectrum in the United States, and you're going to get a huge majority, to the extent that they're informed about the bases, their very existence, you're going to get a huge majority saying, shut them down.
Last year, there was a conference involving anti-war activists and environmentalists. Now, you're talking about bringing together folks on the basis of opposition to U.S. military bases abroad. Is the anti-war movement getting more creative?
I certainly hope so. That was a conference that we did at World Beyond War, and this one is a conference that World Beyond War and U.S. Peace Council and more groups than I can name, you can find them at noforeignbases.org, are collectively putting this together. And I find that coalition building to be encouraging, and the creativity of taking on new angles to address militarism, the fact that the divestment campaigns are being built, not just around Israeli weapons, but war weapons in general, I think is encouraging. The fact that groups are pursuing angles to try to apply the rule of law to war and treat war as the crime that it is encouraging. So there's certainly plenty of bad in terms of the weakness of the peace movement and the normalization of war and militarism and the lunatic who's sitting in the White House. But there are some signs of potential movement and potentially major reaction to bad developments in the world when needed in the coming weeks and months. And there is a good deal of action globally and collaborating across oceans on trying to make peace in Korea, despite all the efforts of the United States government.
That was David Swanson speaking from Washington.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, troops loyal to President Joseph Kabila have killed scores of demonstrators organized by the Catholic Church. Meanwhile, a mysterious army is slaughtering Congolese in the Beni region of the country. The neighboring nations of Uganda and Rwanda are the prime suspects in the mass killings. Tembale Musavuli is an organizer with Friends of Congo based in Washington.
The Congo has faced a political crisis since the end of 2016, mainly because it was expected for Joseph Kabila, who was the president of the Congo then, to step down and organize presidential election. This was the end of his second term of being president in the Congo. Unfortunately, he did not organize election, and he has delayed the process of having an election in the Congo through many different mechanisms. So toward the end of 2016, to prevent the country going into chaos, the religious leaders, mainly led by the Catholic Church in the Congo, organized some form of dialogue, some form of discussion between the regime and the opposition to prevent, as I mentioned, the country going into violence. Through that agreement, through the dialogue, an agreement was signed, and the agreement called for Joseph Kabila to organize election by the end of 2017. So they gave him an extra year to organize election. And what we did see is that it did create some form of calm amongst the political leaders. But what we saw from the regime of Kabila is that they still did not plan for election. They still didn't organize election. So December 31st of 2017, which marked a year from the time that agreement was signed, the Catholic Church leaders in the Congo decided to call on the population, the people of the Congo, to rise up. The reason why they wanted them to rise up is because they saw that they came to a process in faith, that the president of the Congo, in good faith, will organize election, and that did not take place. So they asked the people that on December 31st, 2017, which was a Sunday, after the church service on Sunday, to mobilize across the country, to organize marches. And these marches were supposed to be led by religious singing, prayers, to demand, amongst many things, that the president of the Congo organize election. And of course, political leaders who are in prison be free and so on. Unfortunately, on Sunday, as many expected that people would come out, the Congolese government decided to send security forces to maim the churchgoers. So some churches where people were praying, the churchgoers found themselves locked into the church, tear gas thrown into the church, people shot, killed, priests arrested, and some of the youth leaders and some of the women leaders that we work with contacted us during that time to let us know what was going on the ground. And it's unbelievable to actually see that people who are protesting peacefully, being faced by brute force, a very brutal force that's killing and maiming them. And this happened in total silence. And I could expand more on other tactics that the government used so that people will be literally held as in a prison within their own country.
Well, certainly this is a serious situation for Kabila, because the Catholic Church is certainly not considered to be a radical force in the Congo.
Yes, the Catholic Church has played a pivotal role across the history of the Congo, from even the Mobutu era up until now, to be that force that checks the regime in the Congo. As the religious leaders demonstrated, is they are the only credible force inside of the country. Not the opposition figures, not the regime. The voice of reason in the Congo is the faith leaders, and most of them being from the Catholic Church. Why am I making that strong statement? As I mentioned, they have the capacity to mobilize thousands of people across the Congo. The first time during the Kabila era, we saw their capacity was in the 2011 election. The 2011 election, we had 60,000 polls across the Congo. There were election observers internationally and locally, but the only group that had at least one observer in the polls was the Catholic Church. They had an estimated 60% of the polls in the Congo covered. This is why in 2011, the Catholic Church came out in the Congo clearly stating that the election's results did not reflect truth or justice, and called that the fake result that the Kabila regime presented in 2011.
However, the Catholic Church now is not calling for Kabila to step down, but that he agree not to run in the next elections. You write that the Congolese youth organizations and much of the opposition is demanding that Kabila step down now.
Yes, that is correct. The youth, actually, I should emphasize that even more, the youth is much more radical in calling for Kabila to not run, because the political emphasis, we are clear, and I could say I am very clear, that there is no political process that can take place in the Congo that Joseph Kabila is going to respect. He became president at age 29. He came to the barrel of the gun. He has killed his way through staying in power till now. That at age 45, now he's actually 46. He does not want to leave. He knows that if he leaves power, he may be assassinated. He actually made a statement in a French newspaper Le Monde last month that he believes that the way he's going to die is that someone is going to put a bullet in his head. So when you have a president who believes that he's going to die in power, there is no way he's going to actually leave power. So the youth is clear on the position. The Catholic Church is trying to play a different role. They believe, at least from the church leaders that I've spoken with, is that the population has suffered tremendously, that certain processes of removing the fear out of them will help. And they actually, even though many people were arrested and killed on Sunday, from the people we are in touch with, they called it a success. And the reason why they called protests a success is that living in a oppressive state, a police state as the Congo, that the people who they knew clearly that they would be assaulted by the military, they still went out that morning, went to church, and was able to brave the forces that were against them. And they believe that continuously doing this process will allow the population to gain much more courage to be able to challenge the violence that they face with the security forces on the ground. So that's where the two forces are laying, where the youth are very optimistic, idealistic, and they do know that there is no process that can take place right now that will include Kabila, that will be free and fair, and they're calling for him to step down, and the Catholic Church is calling for opening up much more of the space to allow a process to have a new leader elected.
And what has been the behavior of the United States in all of this, from the Obama administration and now with Donald Trump and his people?
You know, Glenn, I've always had a very tough time explaining to people in the United States the negative role that the United States government has played in Congo's politics from its modern day founding to now, especially before Donald Trump, trying to explain to Americans that Barack Obama has played also a negative role in the Congo. The policies of Barack Obama was clearly to not deal with the politics of the Congo and ignore the issues to allow the next president of the United States to deal with it. So, for example, it's been on the record the many different challenges that the Congo face, from having a government that's killing its own people, yet still receiving military training and support from the United States, from Congo's neighbors being implicated in the looting of the Congo's mineral resources, yes, sanctions are against Congo's neighbors, specifically Rwanda and Uganda, have been very timid, where Rwanda and Uganda see U.S. allies on the so-called war on terror. And then now with Donald Trump's administration, he was able to send Nikki Haley for a visit in the DRC. And to everyone's surprise, she was expecting elections to take place in 2018, which is not as different as when Ambassador Samantha Power in 2016 made a statement calling for an election in the Congo to take place in 2017. So they all are having the same policy, where what's happening in the Congo is not necessarily a national interest of the United States. Their interest lies more on strategic minerals. As long as we can get access to Congo's cobalt, we could care less what's happening to the Congolese people. And it's also being demonstrated with the Trump administration. But the reason why I want to emphasize that is that it will be very easy to attack Trump. He's a misogynist. He does not know how to rule. He has made a lot of mess in the United States, but he did not start with them. Every administration before him has had a negative policy toward the Congo that did not take into account the people of the Congo, but only looked at profit and access to strategic minerals in the DRC.
As you said, the United States' best friends or clients in that part of Africa are Uganda and Rwanda, both of which have contributed heavily to the genocide, the death of more than 6 million people in the Congo. And Uganda is now deploying its forces near the Beni region of the Congo once again.
Yes, you know, the United Nations has the largest UN peacekeeping mission in the world. They have over 20,000 soldiers who are in the Congo. Most of these soldiers, I would say 70 to 80% of them, are actually in the east. And many of them are actually where these crimes are taking place, in Beni. For some reason, for the past 3 to 4 years, massacres of Congolese civilians have taken place in the most grotesque way. Yet, it has not stopped. The killings have been attributed to the so-called ADF, which is a Ugandan rebel group that came into the Congo in the 1990s and who've been operating in the region. Experts have shown that the ADF does not have the capacity to even destabilize Uganda, so there are probably 100 soldiers left. Yet, they claim that these are the people committing the crimes. When you speak to people from the region, they clearly say that they see foreigners, they don't speak about the ADF, who are coming and killing people with machete and chopping off their heads or committing all these different grotesque violence. But for some reason, these individuals are able to come and kill everyone while the UN forces are there. And surprisingly, after 3 years of killing in the Beni area, now the Ugandan government, a foreign government, right, outside of the Congo, decide to send their troops again into the Congo to go after about 100 soldiers, saying that they are the one committing violence. But why are they coming? You know, we had about 12 Tanzanian soldiers from the UN mission who were killed. We do not know by who. And given the narrative I just provided, and given that this has gone on for a while in the Congo, what the listeners or the readers should know is that in the case of the violence in the East, it's been a practice that the Ugandan and the Rwandans will take proxy rebels, infiltrate them into the Congolese society, and they commit crimes, sometimes wearing Congolese army uniform. This is not just a blunt accusation. No, it has been documented in many UN reports that they have actually used that operation. And if I have to use a U.S. analogy, it's almost as Contel Pro. So when the FBI is sending agents into the community to commit violence and then create a pretext for the FBI to engage in the community, knowing that their own agents committed these crimes in the community. So this is what has been going on and on. So we do know that Ugandan's actions in the Congo is not in good faith. It is, again, another attempt to come back into the DRC while they still have not given Congo reparation. And the reason why I'm bringing that reparation back up for this conversation is that Uganda was sued by the Congo. There were Congolese lawyers who were able to build a case against Uganda, took the Ugandan government to the International Court of Justice, and Uganda was found liable for war crimes and crimes against humanity and pillage of Congo's resources at the International Court of Justice. And what the court said back then in 2005 was that Uganda had to pay Congo $10 billion in reparation. So the Congolese are still waiting for the $10 billion that they have to pay the Congo for the crimes they committed. We do not need Ugandan soldiers invading the Congo again under a pretext. We need good neighbors and also accountable neighbors who have been found guilty for crimes against humanity and war crimes. And initially, also I mentioned Rwanda and Uganda. As you hear, I just mentioned that Uganda was the only one found guilty for war crimes and crimes against humanity. So one will ask, but what happened to Rwanda? It's obvious. Rwanda was also sued at the ICJ. But the only reason why the judge did not find Rwanda guilty at the International Court of Justice is because Rwanda never signed the Rome Treaty. They are not party to that court, that the court has no jurisdiction to try them. Do you know what other nation in the world never signed that treaty? The United States. So you cannot try, for example, George Bush at the International Court of Justice or at the International Criminal Court, because they are not party to the court. They never signed the Rome Treaty, so no American citizen can actually be tried in this court.
That was Kambale Musavuli of Friends of Congo.
Political activists are scrambling to find ways to reverse the Federal Communications Commission's decision to do away with internet neutrality. Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with Nabil Hossein, a technical worker and organizer with the Movement for Black Lives in New York City. Hossein points out that big corporations already dominated the internet even before the FCC ruling.
In July, there were complaints to the FCC while net neutrality was still in effect, that Verizon was violating net neutrality by slowing down the traffic of certain sites such as YouTube and Netflix and interfering with people's video streaming. There had been, you know, numerous complaints from before 2015, before the rules were in effect, of other telecoms doing similar things with, say, FaceTime and interfering with people's ability to make video calls with each other. Through some of these applications are really extraordinarily important to their users. Like, for example, you know, obviously for a deaf person, an ordinary telephone is not going to be a very useful tool for communicating. On the other hand, FaceTime, which allows people to communicate in sign language, is very useful. And it's something that certain prisons, you know, not necessarily the app FaceTime, but will use a similar application, some kind of video relay. Once this rule change comes into effect, that these telecoms will be allowed to charge different amounts for different types of content, they could essentially jack up the price for making calls for the deaf population or for other vulnerable disabled populations, such as people who are incarcerated or other things of that nature.
We also discussed the fact that there are possibilities outside of the very limited pool of ISP corporations that most people currently utilize. Could you talk about some of those alternatives that are in the works and how viable those might be moving forward?
In some ways, we can maybe draw a comparison to the debate over the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare some years ago, where you might recall there was discussion of a so-called public option where maybe anyone, despite their age, might be able to buy into Medicare or some kind of similar program. There have been proposals for essentially municipal broadband, where the city, whatever city that might be, could essentially provide internet service within its borders or, you know, perhaps beyond its borders, right? Like to some of the outlying counties as well. There's a lot of ways you could do this for some low price, and this could have various social benefits, such as this municipal carrier continuing to observe net neutrality, even though it's not required to do so by the FCC, or providing superior service in areas that are not well served by the telecom, which of course tends to have very racist and classist patterns geographically. There are various other benefits that people see from this. I don't believe any large cities in the U.S. have already done this. And it's worth noting that in certain places, the state might prove very hostile. And by this, I mean like a state like Mississippi, for example, in Jackson, Mississippi, Cooperation Jackson. But yeah, so basically there are proposals for cities to provide municipal broadband, which could observe net neutrality and be at a more affordable price than some of these telecoms, which essentially use monopoly power to charge a very large amount for what really should be considered a public utility and a public service. Just like, you know, the airwaves that radio and television use, another natural resource like air or water, it's actually kind of ridiculous that these companies are allowed to monopolize people's access to communications in this way. So as well as efforts at the municipal level, there are also completely decentralized community efforts at having wireless mesh network, which is essentially peer-to-peer communication without a central intermediary such as an internet service provider, whether that is a private company or any government or any other group that might do this.
You mentioned the municipal level, and you mentioned on the level of the community with these mesh networks. What are some of the other local or even individual efforts that we can make to prepare for and to combat the kinds of throttling of our internet connections or our internet access that we can expect to occur after this repeal of net neutrality?
One step that individuals can take or organizations can take if they haven't already is to use a technology called a virtual private network, or VPN. When you use a VPN, basically all of your traffic goes between your own computer and your VPN first before it goes to whatever other website that you're actually trying to access. And because all of communication with this intermediary VPN is encrypted, your ISP won't know which website that you're trying to access. Like, all they can really tell is that you're using a VPN to do all of your browsing. There are various VPN providers that charge, you know, a monthly fee or a yearly fee. In some ways, this kind of just transfers the problem that, you know, before the ISP was sitting in between you and all of your different, you know, websites or whatever other applications that you're using over the internet. Now the VPN is doing that instead, and maybe you have some reason to believe that your VPN is less bad than Verizon or Comcast or whoever. And in many cases, that's probably true, but in some ways, a better option, if you have the technical skill, either personally or within your organization, is to host your own VPN so that you basically have greater control over your own communications.
Were one looking to assist or support somehow these kinds of efforts and initiatives, what are some groups or the like that you would point toward where people could lend their support?
Yeah, I certainly recommend taking advantage of the resources that are provided by organizations such as the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They have various guides for how to use various technologies such as Tor and Signal and VPN, like I just mentioned. It is necessary, although, you know, these technologies can be useful in protecting yourself online, it is necessary to have some understanding of how they work and what they don't protect you from in order to use them effectively. So I do recommend taking advantage of those resources. In terms of efforts that I might ask folks to direct resources to, I'm thinking a lot about an article that ran on Afropunk.com by a writer named Hari Ziad, who asked, where were internet access crusaders when Facebook stopped horror games from streaming cops murdering her? And I think it's a very sharp and necessary critique of a lot of these, you know, internet freedom organizations, which have really failed to account for, you know, the particular dangers that Black folks face using the internet. Like, we see the extreme level of harassment of Black people, especially Black women, on Twitter, you know, which that company has done pretty much nothing about. Similarly, when Facebook engaged in pro-police censorship of Corinne Gaines' ability to live stream what was happening to her and her child last year, unfortunately, a lot of these groups, you know, while they do some very good and necessary work, were really nowhere to be found in that instance. So I don't know that I would really recommend directing whatever resources that folks do have access to towards that. Depending on where folks are, there may be some of these groups that are working at the local level, whether to lobby their municipality to become an internet service provider, or if folks are working independently towards having mesh networks where different devices can communicate with each other directly without going through one of these centralized intermediaries of an ISP, that might be kind of a better and more promising use of grassroots resources.
And your point is well taken. We can see this from any issue, whether it be the question of criminalizing addiction, environmental justice, all down the line. We see that our darker communities across the country and globally are getting the brunt of these developments, and the focus does not seem to be on these communities by and large. What do you see as the particular impact that this is likely to have on those communities?
Yeah, I mean, we already see now, I mean, if you look at where high-speed internet is available, for example, it's less likely to be in areas where Black people tend to live. When you look at the increased ability that telecom companies, which are, you know, again, largely the same phone and cable companies, are also the ones providing internet service, they're likely to use the increased power they have to engage in discrimination between different types of content. And the same way that many of these companies, like we were just discussing, the way that Facebook collaborated with police, this wasn't even like a case of a warrant, right? This wasn't like Facebook was legally obligated to do this. They just chose to collaborate with police. And to the extent that this doesn't force anyone, but it does guide people towards using certain services over the others, then this increased centralization makes it easier for the state to engage in targeted censorship, like what Corinne Gaines faced, which, given the government's, you know, track record of targeting Black people, especially Black organizers and activists, but not always, you know, even just ordinary Black people, I can't imagine it's going to be a positive development. There's a saying from a science fiction author named William Gibson, which is that the future is already here, just unevenly distributed. And if we look at this distribution, we'll typically see poor people, which, you know, of course, is not perfectly correlated, but largely correlated with race. And so many Black people in the United States have access to much less computing power. They're less likely to own their own devices. They're less likely to have internet at home. They're less likely to have high-speed internet if they do have internet. In a highly racialized and unequal context like the ones that we live in, you know, both in the United States and in, you know, throughout the entire world, there's a huge disparity in terms of the ability of people to access all kinds of resources, including computational and communications resources. And, you know, we've already seen the internet become, in a very short time, just a few decades, that has really become very fundamental to the infrastructure of society. You know, it's hardly optional to use the internet when so many things, like you want to look for a job, right? You got to pay your rent, and, you know, the resumes are only being accepted online, right? And so this tends to exacerbate existing inequalities when only certain people have access to internet at home, or due to the discriminatory way that different telecom companies have kind of rolled out their infrastructure, Black people are less likely to have access to high-speed internet, if we even do have internet at home at all. And with this move of the FCC towards repealing net neutrality, to the extent that, that disadvantaged people are able to use the internet at all, it becomes even more than it was before. It becomes even more kind of at the whims and the discretion of the company to charge them as much as they think that they can get away with charging, to slow down access to applications that maybe, you know, whatever suit or whoever at Comcast thinks is just optional, like, oh, do you really need YouTube? Do you really need FaceTime? Do you really need whatever it is? But kind of as we discussed earlier, people may really need it, you know? FaceTime may be the best way for someone to communicate because of a disability that they have, or they might be watching their class lectures on YouTube. You know, it's an increasingly common practice for, you know, college courses and other educational contexts to put their material online in this way. And to the extent that people have trouble accessing this information, it only increases existing inequalities, you know, contrary to the promise of the internet to create a more interconnected society and decrease inequality. So I do think that this step by the FCC is a negative sign of increasing corporate control and centralization over essential communication media. And I hope that the efforts to fight back, whether that is municipal ISP or community-controlled mesh networks or the efforts of individuals and groups to protect themselves by adopting technology designed to enhance privacy, I really wish the best success for those efforts because, yeah, unfortunately, we're seeing more of the same negative trends of attempts by capitalist entities to just take control over more and more of people's lives.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.